previously on Unsolved. 2 years after John's death, his family doesn't have any answers.
Well, I'm just totally resentful of everything, of our police system. I have no faith at all in them.
The first detective who was assigned to the case, Howard Hingis of the Hales Corners Police Department, didn't have what we would consider adequate training today. The FBI tells him to look for a homosexual or bisexual man, and he zones in on one suspect, a construction worker. From the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, this is Unsolved, a murdered teen, a 40-year mystery. I'm Gina Barton. There were so many issues with the initial investigation into John Zara's death. He was just 14, and he disappeared from Franklin High School, so there were huge amounts of publicity. Officers didn't have the sophisticated training cops have today. The five different agencies working on the case had a whole host of issues with jurisdiction and communication. An FBI profiler told the investigators to look for a gay or bisexual man, but that really limited the scope of the investigation. So in 2001, when Detective Kent Schoonover of the Hales Corners Police Department takes over the case, it's not surprising that it's gone unsolved for 25 years.
Well, when I started looking at the Zara case again, it was 2001. And it was the 25th anniversary of John's death, was that year. And I just started thinking about it. Plus, we got contact by his family, Phil Zara's brother, Mark Zara's brother. And in the 70s and 80s, there wasn't any DNA technology. Well, in 2001, now we had DNA technology. So I thought, okay, hey, let's take a look at this. Let's look at the DNA, and we'll be able to solve this. And quite frankly, I thought, this is easy. We have some DNA on file, hopefully. Pull out the evidence, get a crime lab report, get a DNA hit. Hit the suspect with, here, it's your DNA, get the confession, and we're done. You know, that's what I thought in the beginning. It obviously did not work out that way.
There were some problems with the evidence in this case. Apparently, there were swabs taken to try and find evidence of sexual assault, but they were not in the box. And the medical examiner at the time told the police pretty shortly, even after the crime, that someone told her that they didn't need them so she could throw them away. She said there were slides, but when they tested the slides, there was actually no biological evidence on them. So that was a problem.
And going through the reports, we went through the autopsy reports, and they talked about samples taken from the body and slides made of the samples. Well, let's see if we can find the slides. Went and made some phone calls, and in the 70s, the medical examiner's office was in the basement of the safety building downtown. And that's a very old building. And you're asking someone to find a file from 25 years ago that's probably somewhere in storage. And it was within a couple of days, I got a call back from going, we found it. We found the slides. I was like, wow, that's great. So I went down and picked them up, and they were still all sealed in wax and still looked in very good condition and stored properly. And I thought, oh, this is going to be great, you know, because the autopsy notes stated that they located semen and made slides. Well, semen obviously is a great DNA medium. And so got those to the crime lab, and we had very, very high hopes, and those were dashed very, very quickly with the there's nothing there.
It was amazing that they even found the evidence in the first place, because it was for a long time stored in the basement of the safety building, which is this building that was in really bad shape even back then. And then there was a flood. So they did find the box, but the other issue is that the rock that they believed was the murder weapon was just kind of thrown on top of a box. And so apparently there was blood and hair and other evidence on this rock back at the time. But by the time Schoonover picked it up, there was nothing on it. The other thing is that when John's body was found, the word hell was written on his wrist in block letters. And if you look at some of the handwriting of some of the suspects, they liked to use block letters. But no one at the time took a picture of that writing that was on John's wrist, so it can't be compared. Schoonover came to talk to a class I taught at the University of Wisconsin's campus here in Milwaukee. Here's what he told my students about the evidence.
Collecting evidence was not the forte of the officers involved in this case. They were in over their heads, flat out.
Schoonover worked on John's case off and on from 2001 until 2009. He really hoped to find some DNA evidence that would bring the killer to justice. He had a suspect in mind. We won't go into who that was just now. And he kept trying to prove a case against that suspect.
When I started looking at this case, I made the fundamental error. I went in with tunnel vision. My goal was to prove the suspect that we had developed is guilty. That's the way I went at this. And I went at it for about 8 years that way, up until about 2008, 2009. And that was a huge mistake on my part. Should never have done it that way.
Then, one day, Schoonover got a break.
In 2009, I was heading up to another homicide conference up in Green Bay. And on my way up to Green Bay, I get a phone call from my boss, Ken Bagansky, at the time the chief. And he says, I need you to come back. Greenfield has arrested this guy on a sexual assault case. And they uncovered information regarding the Zira case.
Dan Acker was a swim coach in a couple of rec departments, and he also had worked at the mental health complex. And the police had talked to him back in the 70s about John, because the day after John's body was found, he was found standing near the crime scene in the park.
How would I describe him? He's of, I'd say, normal intelligence. Not someone that I would exactly say is personable, but I think he better related to early teens and boys. He was into models. He was into things that kids of that age would have been into.
Well, Detective Schoonover's reaction at first was, yeah, they talked to this guy back in the 70s. He's not the guy. He didn't do it. Whatever. This weirdo again. But the more information he got and the more that he looked into some of the other things that had happened, he started to think like, oh, maybe this could be the guy after all. And maybe, you know, they missed somebody who was right in front of their faces back then.
And he is a pedophile. There's no question about it. And his age preference is that early teens, 13 to 15 years of age, that ballpark.
The Greenfield Police Department had received a tip that Acker was a pedophile and had molested young boys. Eventually, Acker was arrested. He admitted to the police that he had inappropriate sexual contact with 20 young boys in their early teens or so. He pleaded no contest to 2 counts of second-degree sexual assault of a child, and he's now at the prison in Oshkosh, and he'll be there for 20 years. So at first, everything was pretty standard. When they searched Acker's condo, in the upstairs, the windows were covered with like sheets and tarps and things, which is a little strange, but not completely off the rails. The things that really disturbed them was when they got down to the basement, there was a model police station and a model fire station. And inside the walls were little pictures of dead and missing children. And above each one, there were these little LED lights that were programmed to light up, kind of like in a museum would be.
And these matchbox cars, and on the bottom of the matchbox cars were the names of all these victims from throughout the country. And obviously John Zira's picture and his name on a car was part of it.
Here's some audio of the police interrogation of Acker back in 2009.
As I told you before, after this young boy was killed and I was trying to do all this stuff, it struck me so hard that I decided I would dedicate my hobby to kids that might have either been taken by crime, cancer, medical illness. So to make the hobby even more meaningful to me, I would put their names on certain vehicles. He's on that vehicle because it's a police vehicle, so obviously that was a criminal murderer. So that's why, that's a detective car, the gold.
Police also recovered a photo album and a journal about John's case, with entries that started in 1976 and spanned decades. It was really unnerving to see the photo album, particularly. There were all sorts of pictures of John and his brothers and his dog and the necklace he was wearing when his body was found and his house. And there were pictures of the crime scene and Acker standing at the crime scene, and he had labeled them all with little numbers with this little label maker. And then in the journal, he would write about, you know, photo number 10 shows the scene where the boy's body was found. Here's an excerpt from the beginning of Acker's journal on the case, read by a narrator from our newsroom.
My efforts are for a youth now gone so early in his life and for his family who now lives on after such a wasteful and terrible loss. Fate played a strange hand in this event and kept me away. I did not understand why, and I feel poorly I did not follow my plans as I had set up for the day. Maybe I could have done something to prevent or interfered with this crime. Even if I failed to do so, at least the young man would have had someone along with him to try and stop this cruel crime. Not looking to be a hero, nor seeking any special recognition, just want this evil person off the streets and unable to assault or kill again. To this end, I dedicate my efforts for John Christopher Zira and his family.
It was pretty creepy, even for seasoned law enforcement.
I've never seen anything like that before. It was like, oh man, I think we got something here that we need to look at.
But Acker's next move would leave them all baffled. Next time on Unsolved.
A few weeks ago, a man approached the Ziras, claiming to have information from a source who may have been in Whitnall Park when John Zira died. The man, who we will call Dan, admitted that he himself had been a suspect in the case, but had passed a lie detector test.
Unsolved is produced by Katie O'Connell and narrated by me, Gina Barton, reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. The project was edited by Greg Borowski, with web design by Aaron Coy, graphics by Lou Saldivar, and video by Bill Schultz. You can find more online at jsonline.com/unsolved.